I'm Jessica Wilson, and you're listening to Making It Awkward. Welcome back. Today, you'll hear my conversation with Dr. Asher Laramie about the research on Ozempic and weight loss, also about diabetes and prediabetes. Asher's voice may sound familiar to you from the follow-up episode on BMI and gender-affirming care with Dr. Blair Peters. Asher critiqued Blair's white saviorism, and he invited a conversation about white saviorism in medicine and his whiteness overall in this episode, which we get into in the last third of our conversation. In the last episode with Dr. Chucks, I limited my analysis and critiques in that moment. I was really thinking about what it looked like to critique a Black person in the eating disorder field for centering whiteness yet again. But this time I decided to pause, slow down, and think of it as a systemic problem rather than Chuck's own personal problem. And I'm glad I did. On my Instagram post about that episode last week, actually, it was Asher Laramie who was quick to comment about how he wanted a fat person to write a book about eating disorders and tagged in some other white folks to join this conversation. Again, on my post, which was about race. In my post, I talked about how quickly it can be for white people in the eating disorder field to respond to a conversation about race with, "That's nice, back to me and what I want." And again, I was reminded in that moment that the centering of whiteness is not a concept. It's something that actively happens every day. We see white folks inserting themselves into conversations that aren't about them. It's not just something that people of color know contextually. It's something that we see unfolding right before our eyes every day. It can be hard to look away and remember that things can be different. Here's my informational and then very awkward conversation with Dr. Asher Laramie. Asher, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited. Literally, I've been looking forward to this all day.
I'm so glad. Let's get right into your bread and butter topics. I have most appreciated your GLP-1s and diabetes conversations that you've started on the interwebs. When it comes to GLP-1s, are there one to three things that you wish people would know or remember in the conversation that you don't see very often?
So the first thing that I think people really need to understand about these drugs is that they don't work for long periods of time. We all know that the body is not designed to shrink. And every time someone tries to shrink themselves, it's successful for the beginning. Like, people will generally always lose weight. There's very few circumstances where they won't. Some lose more than others. But eventually we hit the peak of weight loss and we start to restore. And that is the case with these GLP-1 agonists we go via Ozempic, whatever you want to call it, is that, yeah, you see this dramatic weight loss, and it is dramatic, but it doesn't last. And everyone says, oh, that's only when you stop them. That's not true. Like, we know that when you stop them, the weight restoration is so rapid. We've never seen anything so fast before. Actually, it's one of the most rapid forms of weight gain or weight restoration we've ever seen, mm-hmm. even compared to all the other weight loss drugs that came before. So that's very dramatic. But I'm talking about when you're still on the drug. And people, this is the step 5 study I'm referring to, and it really angers me. If you look at the actual graph that shows the weight loss of this group of people who took this drug for 2 years, not one, but 2 years. It's the only study that looked at it for 2 years. What you notice is people keep losing weight until week 68, which is, beyond 1 year, right? Like, it's 68 weeks, but then it takes the first 16 weeks, like, getting on the drug, building up the dose. So actually, it's roughly a year from when you're on the full dose. But then that's when you hit the peak. And then you start going up. And what's really frustrating is that week 52, which is at the end of year one, there was about average 16% weight loss. Then it went down further to almost 18%. And then it started going back up again. By the time they finished the study, it goes back up to 16%. So the conclusion of the study is that you can sustain weight loss between 1 and 2 years, because they just ignored the bit where you went down and then went back up again. If you actually look at this graph and just drew a line based on the trajectory of the graph, you will see that weight restoration will happen within roughly 5 years. So these drugs haven't been around long enough. And the company that makes them, Novo Nordisk, is counting on the fact that they are going to make their billions before people realize these drugs don't work in the long term. Because once we figure that out, the hype will be gone. People will be like, oh, it's a waste of time. So not only are these drugs harmful, they cause lots of side effects. They're very unpleasant at the doses you need to lose weight. So at 2.4 milligrams, side effects are pretty horrible. Not only do we not know anything about the long-term side effects and the long-term implications, but actually they don't work long-term, just like everything else. They don't work long-term. So it's the lying that really gets me. It's the way that they take the data and they sort of, you know, they tease it and they kind of fluff it. Or maybe that's a poor choice of word, but you know what I mean? They're lying to us, and you have to look real, real close to see it. And that really frustrates me. So they don't work. And as I said, they're harmful. And really what I need people to do is I need people to go and watch any of the programs, the TV shows, or read any of the books, or listen to any of the podcasts that were ever written or, you know, about Purdue and OxyContin. Because you will see so many similarities. There's a drug company that's a bit of a middle of the road drug company. No one's really heard of them. They have this ability to turn a short release medication, like a fast acting medication, into a long one. They take a drug called oxycodone, which is quite shit. It's not a particularly good one. They add this long, slow release thing, and they convince the FDA to let them sell it to people with moderate pain. That's all they did. And they caused an opioid epidemic that has ravaged the United States of America now for over 20 years. Before fentanyl, before all of that stuff, came Oxy. Without Oxy, we wouldn't have the problems you have. And I should say you have, because we don't have this problem in the UK, because it was never licensed in the UK. So if you want to understand just how evil drug companies are and how much damage they can do, just look at what they did 20 years ago. I promise you, 20 years from now, we'll be looking back at Novo Nordisk and be like, oh, I can't believe we let them get away with this. But yeah, I mean, history is simply repeating itself, and we're just going to allow it to happen. So that would be my other thing, is watch Dope Sick, or I forget what the other one's called. They're both good. And then you can go, ooh, that sounds familiar. That's going on right now with Novo Nordisk. Wow.
I love connecting dots. That was great. Thank you. I will have to go. And I actually was aware of your work, I want to say, in 2020. Were you either involved with the drug studies or with Novo Nordisk, or am I making my memory up?
So I have very few connections with Novo Nordisk, apart from the fact that I was in a documentary by Vox Media.
Oh.
And I knew at the time of Novo Nordisk's input in that they were putting up the money. And I struggled for a very long time about whether or not I wanted to be in this documentary, because I really wanted to be in this documentary. It's called Embodied. It features a group of fat people.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt
you. So it features a very diverse group of fat people. And I was passionate about the project and the people who were making the project. And when I found out it was being funded by Novo Nordisk, I was devastated. And to be fair, this was a while ago when I agreed to do it. It was 2021, I think, when I agreed to be in it. And it was filmed in 22. I think if I knew now, then what I knew now, I probably would have said no. Just because I'm realizing more and more just how diabolical this drug company is. But I have never been paid by Novo Nordisk. I was paid by Vox Media, and Novo Nordisk had absolutely zero input into the making of the documentary. It was paid for by them, but they had no, and I made it very clear to them at the time, I will be cursing this company every day from now when we record until it comes out. So if that's going to be a problem, I can't be in it. And of course, I have been doing that. I've been speaking out about Novo Nordisk ever since. And that, you know, I don't have a contract that says I can't do that or anything. But I've never worked with them, but I have taken secondhand money from them. Actually, I didn't get paid, so it's not even that. But my name, my face and my name is in a documentary that is sponsored by Novo Nordisk. I have full disclosure, you know, like the disclosure forms. Other than that, there's pure hatred.
Yeah. I mean, I would do a lot of things for money if somebody was going to be. I would be myself for many a corporation if they wanted to pay me to be myself. So it's good.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I won't pay. They can't pay me to say something on their behalf. But if they want to pay me to just say that, you know, I spent the entire time saying it's fine to be fat and BMI is bullshit and all this stuff. So, I mean, like, it's in the film. You could watch me say BMI is bullshit. So, you know, they are which is very clever. They have a very clever marketing and PR department. They are co-opting the language of fat activists, and they have been for some time. And there are some incredible people talking about it. I think people should go listen to them talk about it. I know Mikey Marcus that talks about it a lot, and a lot of people in that group. I know Reagan Chastain talks about it. A lot of people have been talking about it. Who else? Louise Adams over in Australia. You should like totally listen to what they're saying about how they're co-opting language. That's very problematic. That's me and Novo in a nutshell. Other than that, sworn enemies.
Thanks. I really was only remembering that this morning when I was like, what? How long? I guess it was 2021 then, maybe, that I started getting connected to your work. So thanks. The stuff on diabetes that I've really appreciated, at least you having out there for people to see, is the impact of like stress and sleep on A1C. As a clinician, you know, I recorded a few episodes ago, one about diabetes, and I was, you know, pushing or nudging the idea that, you know, me spending all this time on nutrition intervention, you know, when somebody is experiencing trauma, is in a violent situation, has, you know, experiencing acculturative stress, like, will just be them continually talking to me and perhaps feeling shame for not seeing any, you know, quote, changes or quote, improvements. Yeah. And yeah, it's not great out there.
It's not. And I keep telling all of my clients this, because a lot of my clients have diabetes. My husband, and I'm sure he won't mind me telling you this, has diabetes. I have diabetes. And one of the things is that he has to measure his sugars every day because of the medication he's on. I never measure mine, ever. There's no need. I have type 2, which is why I keep telling my clients, why are you measuring? Don't measure. Only measure if you absolutely have to. And the only reason to measure your sugars when you're a type 2 diabetic is if there is a risk of you having a hypo. Like, otherwise we're monitoring your, like, you know, your glucose levels with regular A1Cs. And by regular, I mean every 3 to 6 months. Why are you doing it sooner than that? You know, and I'm noticing a lot of my clients, especially the ones in the US, are being over-treated, over-monitored, over-policed. And it's not okay, because this is massively adding to their stress. Every client I have, I say to them, I bet you what you eat will not determine what your sugar looks like the next morning. Like, it won't. It's the impact of your stress. And that's not necessarily like going to be like an immediate, you know, sort of obvious connection. But if you're really stressed, your A1C will be higher. Your blood sugar will be higher. Like, stress causes so much of a disruption of that insulin pathway. But it also causes inflammation, chronic inflammation. It causes, you know, you to be releasing all of this cortisol into your body, which impacts all of you. It means you get less sleep, and that's going to impact your diabetes. So for me, I'm just like, the most important thing is to try to manage your stress. And again, I find it very, you know, I used to be like, oh, you want to reduce your stress, which feels very wellness culture now. If you're living in the kind of situation where actually you cannot help the stress that you're under, if you're living in a marginalized body, if you're living in a particular neighborhood that isn't safe, if your job is constantly being threatened, if you are on a low income, there are certain situations you can't get out of, in which case my advice is always like, how do we work with you to manage the stress that we can manage? Like, I get that you're constantly having to work. So when we're talking about lifestyle choices, I'll be like, so convenience food actually feels like a good thing for you, right? Like, you know, and you might need to feed yourself at times that are not, you know, 3 meals a day with 2 snacks in between. You might have to be eating on the go. You might have to be, you know, grabbing things as you go. But for me, putting so much stress on that person to eat a certain way, which is what we fixate on with diabetes, eating and exercise, actually puts much more strain. You know, you've got a single mother of three children who's working a job and a little job on the side. And now you're saying you have to cook from scratch and you have to go to the gym five times a week. Like, have you lost your mind? That is going to make their diabetes so much worse. So, yeah, I can't stress enough how important stress is.
Can you speak to the stress and insulin sensitivity bit? When I was at UC Davis, you know, I'd see grad students who perhaps had prediabetes, which we can discuss if we have time, whether or not it's real. Yes. And they were in the nutrition department and would come in very aware, like, this is not a situation of carbohydrates, of sugar. It's a situation of insulin. And can you say a bit more how you perhaps explain that to your clients?
Oh, yeah. We're obsessed with carbs, aren't we? I mean, like, we were joking before about bread. But we're obsessed. We've got to stop, especially with this is how people with diabetes. And I understand this because I quit dieting. 2020, I started learning about intuitive eating. I started eating and I developed a much healthier relationship with my body and with dieting in 2020-21. Then I got my diabetes diagnosis. I was not trying to lose weight, but I found myself picking up the same old patterns. And it was things like avoiding bread, avoiding carbs, all the stuff that we've been told is bad for you. It's not. And I'm not a nutritionist. I'm not a dietitian and I'm not an expert, but I am confident because I have A, done the research or read the research, and B, listened to experts like you, that it is not about sugar. It really isn't. We've got to stop obsessing about that, because even when we look at why it is some people develop diabetes and other people don't develop diabetes, especially people who have insulin resistance. Some of them go on, some of them don't. Why? And we look at the research into that. You know, it's not even based on the insulin pathway. There's something called glucose effectiveness, which has nothing to do with insulin and impacts whether we develop diabetes or not. So our obsession with carbs has to stop. We don't understand it enough. But with insulin resistance, I always tell my patients, you are making insulin. In fact, you're probably making a lot of insulin. Sometimes you're making too much insulin. The issue is in every single cell in your body, some of the insulin receptors, which I describe as locks, lock mechanisms, you know, and insulin is the key. Those lock mechanisms are not working. You can stick as many keys in there as you like. The lock's not working. And as a result, the sugar isn't getting to the cell. And as a result, if you're not getting enough sugar into your cells are tired, which is why you're tired. And also some of that excess sugar in the blood is going to get stored in fat, which is why you might find yourself gaining weight with insulin resistance and possibly when you develop diabetes as well. This is natural. This is what happens. There is nothing we can do to reverse this. But I tell people that what we need to be more focused on is how this is going to impact your body, not whether or not there's too much sugar in your blood, not whether or not there are enough keys or how many locks are not working. And if these things are important, but what the evidence is showing is we need to be focusing on the long term, like damage to your heart, the blood vessels in your body and your kidneys and your eyes, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we know for a fact that chronic inflammation has a massive impact on all of these organs.
Yeah.
It increases your blood pressure. It messes with your cholesterol. It does all sorts of things, chronic inflammation and chronic stress. So if we want to practice holistic medicine, we got to stop focusing on sugar and start focusing on the whole body and wellness as a whole. And when we start doing that, we need to start talking about the social determinants of health. We need to start talking about justice and fairness and all of that stuff before we focus on whether you're eating too much bread, because my goodness, that is the least of your concerns at this stage in your life, probably, you know? If everything else is going swimmingly in your life, hey, look, if you are so privileged that there isn't a single thing wrong, then please feel free to focus on your sugar. The rest of us need to kind of like deal with just living first, and then bread can come into the equation afterwards. That's why I love bread.
And then bread. We need to even talk about the bread at all at that point. Can you talk about stress, chronic stress, and insulin sensitivity and absorption? I'm just enjoying this and I'm sure it will be helpful for folks who are listening and wondering about their own bodies.
Yeah. So, like, we can only go with what we've got, right? We can only go with the evidence that we've got. There are several studies now that show that stress increases your insulin resistance.
Okay.
So like a stress, even if it's a short-term stress, so like not an acute stressor, will increase your insulin resistance, and an absolutely long-term stress increases your insulin resistance. We know it interferes with the insulin pathway. There are so many theories as to how that happens.
Okay.
But it does. Yeah. Like we can say that with confidence. And every time we diet, and this is so important, every time we diet, we interfere with the insulin pathway. We put our bodies under stress. Two things, and perhaps these two things go hand in hand. All I know is the metabolic consequences of that in the long term far outweigh any benefits that we see in the short term. And when you look at the long-term evidence in diabetes, there are some brilliant long-term studies, which is quite nice because that doesn't exist for that many conditions. Diabetes is one of these conditions that has been researched a ton. And so they were people who set out to prove that weight loss would either prevent diabetes or would treat diabetes or would reverse diabetes. They did these long-term studies and they failed every time. And it's quite nice to be able to say, oh, you tried to prove that, but you failed. So therefore it's not true. And I often talk about these three studies that I find particularly helpful, like long-term, but we know stress is involved and we know stress interferes with the insulin pathway, increases insulin resistance. But as I said, it also causes chronic inflammation. And I would argue that that's more worrying. Like, I'm less focused on your insulin pathway because you know what? The studies, the long-term studies of type 2 diabetics are showing actually it is not the same as like type 1 diabetes. I often say, look, type 1s, I know it's much harder, although they also have insulin resistance and they're also fat shamed and all sorts. But with type 2 diabetes, we make this big drama out of something. It's actually very treatable. It's quite manageable. We have lots of drugs and lots of options. And, you know, instead of fixating on weight and food, we could just be like, oh, take this medicine, one tablet, or nowadays, you know, like once a week medication. Great. It's not the end of the world. If you have asthma, you take an inhaler. And if you have high, you know, low thyroid, you take thyroid medication. Like, it's not that big a deal.
Yes. The shame there. I find the same with hypertension. I'm like, it's a teeny tiny, you know, little pill. Yes. But like, what if I have to deal with this long term? And I'm like, I have epilepsy. Like, you don't shame me for taking, I take six pills. What? Yeah. Twice a day plus supplements. Yeah. And nobody has thoughts about that. Well, there are the like weird wellnessy people who are like, maybe if you had more dust in your diet, you
wouldn't. Someone has an opinion about that, surely. But the hypertension is a really good example. So is diabetes and so is high cholesterol. These are all conditions that we see higher rates in certain ethnic groups, especially in black. And I imagine in Latina populations in the US as well. I'm not so, we don't have a particularly high population of Latina people here, so I don't know much about it, the demographics. Certainly in South Asians in the UK. So any global majority but ethnic minority group in the US and the UK have higher rates of these conditions, right? And hypertension is very classical. Black people will often have hypertension or will be diagnosed as having hypertension. One could argue maybe that that's because we're using normal values for white people and we've never really looked into whether those normal values apply to black people. I don't know. I'm not an expert. But what I do know is that, yeah, it strikes me as not being that all that surprising that we associate and we stigmatize certain illnesses just to happen to be much more prevalent in certain communities. And it's not just race, but it's also in fat communities and it's also in poorer communities. And so you know, it's not surprising to me that these illnesses are stigmatized much more than say conditions that will affect anybody from any group. Those tend to be a little less stigmatized unless it's like a disability, in which case then the stigma comes all over again. You know, like there's a small group of illnesses that I think come with slightly less stigma. And also the way we treat, say, a white middle-aged man who's had a heart attack is very different to how we treat a black woman who's had a heart attack. A, because we tend to miss her far more often
then.
So mm-hmm. yeah, she tends to have that heart attack before we know it. Sometimes we actually miss it when it happens and we only find out 2 years later and we haven't given her the right treatment. But also when it comes to the stigma, you know, she's had a heart attack because she eats too much fried food or whatever it is that, you know, we're stereotyping in our head. Whereas the white man, we're like, oh, it's unfortunate, but you can get back to work. Don't worry, sir. You know, you'll be fine. It's a completely different attitude, which leads us into all sorts of conversations if you want to have these conversations. Oh my God. It'd be in my bonnet.
I would love to talk about pre-diabetes with you, including, you know, I tend to go all or nothing on this, calling it fake when, you know, it is real. There, because we've made it real, but also drug companies have created pre-diabetes. And I look at, you know, that lowering and lowering of thresholds for pre-diabetes to, like, I think we should just start pathologizing pre-diabetes. You know, maybe I'll just get on metformin tomorrow and then I'll prevent pre-diabetes. Sure. And children probably, maybe like infants have yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it'll also be like your family. So if your family, somebody in your family has diabetes, then you'll have pre. They'll come up with a different name. Like, they're not stupid. They're great with their PR. In fact, pre-diabetes is a PR stunt. And there is an article about this that I show everybody because it's such a good article, written in Science magazine that talks about the PR stunt that was pre-diabetes. And the doctor, Dr. Khan, I forget his first name, who was the medical director of the American Diabetes Association. And I don't like to blame Americans for everything, but I need you to know that this is absolutely an American problem. You did this. You all did this.
That's right.
The rest of the world was like, we're not doing that. The UK jumped on the bandwagon, to be fair, because we always do. You know what we're like. Like, we are, yeah, you're in charge, and we're like the kind of like, we creep along behind
you.
We lead
the fashion. Yeah.
You lead, we follow. But, so in 2001, in 2001, which just happened to be around the time that the first lot of results came out about diabetes prevention and how it actually wasn't possible for the most part. Around that time, the American Diabetes Association were tasked on to creating a name that was better than impaired glucose tolerance. Because impaired glucose tolerance is what we're talking about here. And there are people who have impaired glucose tolerance that have been on this study, the Diabetes Prevention Program Outcome Study, for 20 years plus and have never, ever developed diabetes. In fact, 40% of them haven't died. Mm-hmm. So there are people who have had at least one instance of impaired glucose tolerance and never developed diabetes. And that's really, I think, telling. And even then, we had an inkling that this was going to be the case. So the American Diabetes Association wanted a new name. And Dr. Khan, who was the medical director at the time, and his team came up with pre-diabetes. And to be fair, the rest of the world went, nah, we don't like this because this suggests that it's pre-diabetes, and it's not. The CDC went with the American Diabetes Association, and nobody else did. Even the WHO refused to go. And there was conferences where they were like, no, we reject this term. There are all sorts of studies that have just made it very clear, no, this is not a thing. We absolutely agree this is not a thing. And even the ADA has like backtracked on a lot of the information that they gave out. But most tellingly, Dr. Khan is on record as saying it was the biggest mistake or regret of his career. And he is on record as saying, if you get diagnosed with pre-diabetes, don't do anything. Just check it again in 3 to 5 years. The dude who came up with it said that. And I think that's telling. And I think it's also telling how much money the CDC has set aside for diabetes prevention and pre-diabetes treatment and how much money has been taken away from, say, cancer prevention and other really important things. Who's benefiting from that? My pals Novo Nordisk have definitely benefited from that, as have every other drug company. So yeah, I got a real problem with pre-diabetes. It is not a thing. I refuse to call it a thing. And whenever anyone says pre-diabetes to me, I'll go, okay, cool. Is it impaired fasting glucose? Is it impaired glucose tolerance? And then they look at me like I've just, you know, I'm talking nonsense, and I say, did you have a fasting blood test? Did you have to do the test where you had to drink the sugar and then check it again, which they almost never had? Almost certainly all they had is an A1C. And that is the most inaccurate way of measuring whether a person has prediabetes. So, yeah, I've got a very strong belief that we've got to stop doing A1C so often. Sure, if you're diabetic, have an A1C. If you're trying to diagnose diabetes, please just do a fasting glucose. It's not that difficult. Do two, and then it's easy to diagnose. We've got to stop obsessing with A1Cs because they're not that accurate.
Tell me more about this.
Well, so... It's a good way of measuring blood glucose over the last 3 months, right?
Yeah.
And for the longest time, every organization, the WHO included, the organizations in the UK, I'm not so sure about the States, to be honest, but we were diagnosing diabetes with a fasting blood glucose. Okay. A glucose tolerance test takes forever and it's too much drama, but you weren't allowed to drink or eat for 12 hours and you had a blood test. And if it was over a certain number, we did it again. And if it was twice, that's it. If it was really, really high the first time, we're like, you know, we can repeat it, but chances are you have diabetes. And then what happened was the A1C came into fashion and sort of took over from the fasting glucose. And there isn't that much, there's certainly not much evidence that having an A1C below the diabetic threshold is going to be able to predict whether or not you have diabetes. So above the diabetic threshold, we use a different system in the UK, you see. So ours is like 48, which is not helpful at all.
Oh, yeah, 100 to 125.
Yeah, okay. So when you get above that 125 threshold, I agree that that's, you know, at that point in time, using the A1C is a good way of measuring diabetes sort of care. But what we're doing is we're doing A1Cs for people who are not, that don't have diabetes. So like in this kind of whole pre-diabetes, and even like now the pre-diabetes. So people are coming to me and going, oh, you know, my, I scored like 6.3. And I'm like, and, you know, oh, I scored 6.2 and I don't get it. Like, why do we care about this? But because in the US, you've got really strict, I think it's 5.6 now. It's not the same in the rest of the world. The rest of the world a bit more laid back. We're like 6. But you all reduced your number, your thresholds to so low that we're encompassing a whole bunch of people who have nothing wrong with them. And then they start stressing and then they go on a diet. Then they go on another diet and they go on another diet. And you know what that does? It increases their insulin resistance and predisposes them potentially to diabetes. So stop. Like, you know, it's not necessary to do an A1C unless we're trying to rule out diabetes. And if we're trying to rule out diabetes, don't do an A1C, do a fasting blood sugar. It's more reliable. And the only time you should be having an A1C is if you have diabetes. And I feel very strongly about this. Now, to be fair, you can use an A1C. You can use an A1C to screen for diabetes. But you know, we've got to stop doing it regularly. It's not helpful. It's this obsession that we've had that and like monitoring our sugars. People are going out and buying blood sugar monitors now for funsies. Like, please stop doing that. That's really not good because your sugar is going to spike throughout the day and it's been spiking
throughout the day since you were a baby. I'm just seeing that on Instagram, but I've not been following because that's not my thing. But yeah, people being upset that it goes up after eating and I'm like, literally, it's what's supposed to do. I don't understand. That's how bodies work. That's a good thing. I'm confused.
You'd think it was a good thing.
Right. I'm glad.
Yeah. If it wasn't, like, you'd probably some kind of weird tumor in your pancreas or somewhere that's releasing insulin unnecessarily. Like, you want your blood sugar to go up after you've eaten, but there's, you know, there are Insta famous people who are obsessed.
I'll have to Google it. Insta famous. I love that. When you did the lovely feedback for Dr. Blair Peters' follow-up episode, you mentioned the whiteness in medicine and the white saviorism that is just often inherent in medicine. And I've seen you go on a journey of understanding whiteness and white privilege and I would say, like, is it doctor privilege, academic privilege, professional privilege, and all class privilege and all of these things. And at the same time, I've definitely gotten feedback I think on the Instagram post of your clip, it was this, Asher, you know, had blocked me after I pointed out their privilege, and that was from a white person. And other folks were like, there's been some stuff historically about talking to Black people a certain way. And I'm like, I would love to have a thoughtful conversation about that if you're open.
Yeah. So I think I'm learning, and I think cards on the table when it comes to academic privilege and white privilege, it's something that I've always had, or certainly, you know, I got my medical qualification in 2003. So pretty much most of my life, and white privilege is something I've always had and didn't really understand. And I think there's so many levels to it, aren't there? And there was, I think for the longest time, my biggest issue was the white savior complex. I don't think I've ever been explicitly racist. I don't think I've ever had sort of explicit racial bias to my knowledge. But of course we all have implicit, you know, anti-Black bias or racial bias. And when I began to become aware of that, perhaps it would have been before 2020, but certainly not that long before 2020. And in terms of like my doctor privilege, I think it was definitely even more recent than that. It's a learning process, right? And so I have got it wrong on many occasions. I think the biggest issue for me, and it was receiving criticism or receiving feedback, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when I felt like my motives were a good thing and, and it came across wrong. It was all like, sometimes when, you know, I did something wrong, I just didn't want to hear it. Like, you know, as a kid, like, I don't want to hear that. Like, I'm a good person. So yeah, of course there have been instances of that. And I think also for me, social media is a new thing. I'm just of that generation that you either, I'm right at the end of Gen X. So you either jumped on the social media bandwagon, which I reckon half my friends did, or you just like maybe had a Facebook account that you updated every 5 weeks or something. And that was it. I got into social media because of the Fat Doctor. Like, I all of a sudden was like, you need a social media presence. And I didn't really understand the rules of social media. I was too naive. And I was also working a lot of my own stuff. I've been in a not so great place, Jessica, if I'm honest. Like, I mean, it's been a hard few years for me in the last 3-4 years. It was a lot of things that were hard. And so it was, you know, I think I allowed that to, at times, impact the way that I interacted with people online. So, yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of people who have very valid complaints or valid criticisms of me. I'd like to think I'm getting better. I like to think I'm learning, and I also think this will be a lifelong journey. How do you how do you undo, you know, 40 years in my case of social conditioning plus? You know, when you're privileged, you miss so many you are oblivious to so many things.
Yeah.
So, you know, cards on the table. I am very much, I don't want to say, guilty is a good word, but I think definitely the white, for me, the white savior, it's a real problem. And it comes from, I think, for me, this desire to be helpful. And also when you're a doctor, you're told not only are you saving people's lives, and you don't just get that told that by your college, you get told that by everybody. Sure. Like, oh, wow, you're a doctor, you save lives. And so, you know, there's this kind of pressure to always know what you're doing and be in control and like be a good person, an ethical person. And, you know, I'm not sometimes. I'm an absolute bitch.
Defensiveness, I think, is just like a hallmark of whiteness. It's like when we draw these Venn diagrams and then right with the doctors know things, like just being conditioned to like know that whatever I am doing is obviously the correct thing because doctor. And then like coming up against, you know, people on social media who like loudly and sometimes softly disagree can definitely be a new place to be more open to critique.
Yeah. And there's a, you know, the defensiveness, I think, also taps into what's going on in our own personal lives because we're humans, right? And I have, you know, I grew up in a very abusive home and I have a desperate like desire to get people to like me. You know, it's something I'm working on. I am trying to be less likable, or not less likable, makes me sound mean, but I'm trying to care less about whether people like me, whether they, you know, I'm trying to stop being a perfectionist. I'm trying to show up in the world imperfectly and authentically and accept that actually I'm probably not that many people's cup of tea. And sometimes I'm going to say things and people are going to get the wrong end of the stick, and I can, but like just be me. And I think some of the biggest issues I've landed myself in have been the defensive. You know, that's absolutely the key thing for me. And the defensiveness, as you say, it's a white privilege problem, and a doctor privilege problem, nail on the head. But, and also it's a, you know, I think there's a deep desire in all of us to just be liked and to be considered nice and kind. And again, that's a whiteness thing, right? Like, I'm a kind person.
Say, I don't feel like that. I know that that is not, yes. I know that people are going to think I'm aggressive and mean. Yes. I don't ever think that people will consider me as such. So I'm not ever looking for that, maybe. It's interesting. I also talked to another person before the Amplify Melanated Voices and things, and was trying to explain why social media was important. She was like, Jessica, this means nothing. Like, boomer, I know, like, but it does. Like, all of these at that time, white women, dietitians, and therapists were getting like so much credit, and we'll put credit in quotes, for saying these social justice things. And I'm like, this is who people are listening to. Like, it matters. Yeah. And then, yes, with Amplify Melanated Voices, it was like, oh, so it does matter. And I'm like, that, like, what we are out there, like, people say it's not real life. And it's not real life, but it's also real life because it has real impacts. It's like the social construction of life. Mm. It's, yeah. And people just figuring out how to be on Instagram and talk to people is always a journey.
It is. I don't like Instagram at all. I don't like social media at all. It is not something I am particularly fond of. But that being said, all these amazing people that I have come to know and I talk to and who are in my life, like I met through Instagram. And so it's like, yeah, double-edged sword or whatever you want to call it. I'm glad it's there. And at the same time, like, sometimes wish I could just turn it off. What I am learning to do is just not argue with anyone who isn't an absolute troll. You know, there are some people who come onto my Instagram account are just spoiling for a fight. And I just delete and block. But sometimes I will say something to them. But I'm trying to not engage in too many conversations now unless I see something that is really bothering me. Or if it's a nice thing that I want to like respond to in a positive way. Obviously, positive comments are good. But I'm just learning a lot of this stuff about myself, you know, that like at the moment I'm going to call it Aries energy, but I have a lot of kind of aggression. I'm in the summer season of my life right now with a lot of kind of passion, and I am learning to like keep my opinions to myself during this period of my life. When I get like this, and this is like, this is cyclical. There are periods in the cycles of my life, and whether it, you know, it has to do with the seasons or whether it has to do with my menstrual cycle or whatever it has to do with, where I recognize, I'm beginning to recognize, because I'm beginning to tune in. Yeah. You're like spoiling for a fight, like rein it in, like stand down, back away, put the phone down. And, you know, I didn't do that when I first started in social media. I was like picking fights with everybody. I'm hoping that I'm getting better and better at that. I'm chilling. I'm mellowing in my old age.
Thank you so much for this conversation. I so appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for letting me be here and for making it awkward.
Okay, to be upfront, I went back and forth with whether to just cut the last 10 minutes of this interview. It was a lot for me to listen to initially, and again for edits. I caught something new each time that surprised me. I was thinking about just presenting key points and summarizing them, but I think letting people hear how these types of conversations go is a learning opportunity in and of itself. This was a perfect example of someone knowing that they should say that they're learning and trying to do better, while at the same time not seeing all of the ways they aren't.
This is not the first time I've been on the receiving end of someone's processing about their whiteness and how it shows up for them. In my book, I talk about how Black women are often the well into which white people pour their feelings. And it's always so interesting to me when people are able to take some things from my book and completely miss others. When it was over, I told my spouse about the interview, asking in exasperation if she could believe it. She replied, frankly, yes. She read my book. She's witnessed how often this happens. The only thing that surprised her is that I was surprised. As you heard in the interview, Asher talking about how he expected to be liked on social media reminded me that I've never had that expectation. Thousands of people like my content, but I'm also able to see how many people unfollow me on a given day, depending on a post. For example, 75 people unfollowed me the day I posted about that infamous letter from my copy editor. It's rough out there for folks who have content that makes people uncomfortable and perhaps have them confront things within themselves. Asher mentioned that he might have a blind spot when talking about how he had been socialized, and there absolutely is. The statement about how someone out there will inevitably get the short end of the stick depending on how he's feeling on social media at the time, and him just learning to be okay with that, was said so flippantly, it surprised me. I can't imagine what it would be like to respond to somebody with anger and expect to just walk away unscathed and without consequence. He mentioned having aggression sometimes on social media, like it could just be a regular Wednesday. For me, the amount of thought and time I spend choosing my words and hoping that I don't come across as aggressive is exhausting. Even when writing this outro, I've thought so long and hard about it. I've consulted with multiple people about whether it's worth it due to any possible backlash that I could receive. My menstrual cycle would never, ever be accepted as a reason for whatever someone thought of me. The stories that white people are able to tell themselves that make sense to them will always surprise me. The things that they're able to do and just walk away with their reputation intact is just unfathomable to me. It sounds really nice. I'm not saying that Asher needs to change, but I would like for me and all of my Black and brown colleagues to be able to use Aries season, Aries energy, as a valid response anytime we're critiqued for making people uncomfortable. People will listen to this and think I'm being mean or insensitive, and I can hold multiple truths at once. I can hold that the information Asher shared about Ozempic and diabetes was very informative and very helpful for many people, including myself, along with the ways that he was able to speak academically, at least, to health disparities, and that in his personal life, these disparities need more investigation. He was able to critique Blair Peters academically and also not see the myriad of ways it showed up between the two of us. Going on in the background of all of this, Asher posted an apology on Instagram last October that I flagged and sent to Whitney. In it, he listed all the ways he had harmed a Black woman and had centered himself in his arguments with her. He said that he had continued to try to contact her via multiple avenues, like it was a good thing, even though she had made a clear boundary of no contact. In the essay, he continued to center himself, and it read as a Catholic confessional. This, in addition to our conversation, his comments on my Instagram post, and other feedback that I've gotten about him, seems consistent with someone who has a lot of interrogation to do. And sometimes that dissonance just sucks. Whew, this has been your very awkward host, Jessica Wilson. I hope you can all join me in awkwardness in your own lives. Next week, I'm bringing us all a palate cleanser. I decided to interview my dad, this time about his time picking cotton, about how the food he ate growing up became a foodie's favorite, and you'll get extended versions of him co-hosting Ultra Processed Fridays with me. If you like these awkward conversations, I'd love a rating or review. You can also join the Patreon from the show notes, where you'll get bonus content and extra dad content. This has been Making It Awkward. If you have feedback, you can send it to makingitawkwardpod@gmail.com. You can watch this episode on YouTube and Spotify. This is a production of The Body Politic and is supported by Patreon members like you and the legacy of Sacramento Outward Services. All of the social media clips you see are done by Jen Jacobs, who also edits and mixes the show.